Good morning. It is the 13th of April, Saturday, 2024, in Eastertide. And I hope you all are having a blessed start to your day. And for those of you who are watching in some far-flung part of the world, far away from where I'm sitting in central Oklahoma, I hope you're having a great day. Some prayers would be appreciated for us here, judging from some storm chasers who are experts at predicting weather. We're going to have an interesting day on Monday. Mostly, I think it's going to be people north of me in Kansas are going to be having an interesting day. But prayers appreciated. We got a potentially interesting weather coming towards us on Monday, so prayers appreciated. We're going to talk today about, I've been sitting on this letter from Archbishop Hector Aguirre for a few days now. Just haven't had the chance to talk about it. I've had it since before Dignitas Infinita dropped on everybody, and that just threw my whole schedule off. But we're going to talk about this because it actually, in a weird way, illustrates kind of the problems we're dealing with today that are really illustrative in that document, but more in general, the problems in the church today. Before we get to that, I do want to thank everybody who's donated to the Give, Send, Go. For those who don't know, on Easter, I did a live stream where I announced that my wife and I are expecting child number four. And there are some complications, not to be clear, involving the baby, but what happens when your family grows above a certain size and other things. And a viewer started a Give, Send, Go to try to help out with that, which I, as I mentioned on Easter or in the day when I first made public that that was actually being done by somebody, my instinct is always to turn down help, but I once had a priest tell me that I need to learn to stop doing that. So I'm just grateful for the help that people are offering. There would be a link in the pinned comment below when the live stream is over. So let's get to the story from Archbishop Hector Aguirre. If you're not familiar with him, he was the Archbishop of La Plata, Argentina. He used to tussle with Francis, Cardinal Bergoglio, in Argentina. La Plata is where Cardinal Fernandez became the ordinary of later. And Hector Aguirre would take the generally Catholic position on things. And all too often, Cardinal Bergoglio would not. He would take some modernist kind of thing. And they would often argue. And there was no love lost between them. And when Bergoglio became Francis, Cardinal Aguirre's days were numbered in the episcopate. And he had age 75, the day mandatory retirement age. However, it's mandatory with an asterisk next to that, right? The way it works is a cardinal or a bishop or anybody else who hits that age will submit a letter of resignation to the Holy See. And if the bishop is in good health, the letter comes and goes. Nothing, no response. And the bishop keeps serving until at some point the reigning pontiff decides to replace him or until the bishop passes away or whatever, right? Typically, though, doesn't go past 80, although there have been cases where even that was waived. Within hours of his submission of that letter to the Holy See, he got a response accepting his resignation. There was no time lost in replacing him. And now we have Cardinal Fernandez in that post, or we did before he became the prefect for the now dicastery for the doctrine of the faith. To give you an idea of some of the dynamics going on here, and for those of you who are skeptical of anybody opposing Francis, this will, I'm sure, some will fuel some speculation that Hector Aguirre writes these public letters in opposition because he's just got a beef with Francis. And if you believe that, that's your call. But he's writing this letter in response to something that Archbishop Garcia Cuerva, who had been appointed as the Archbishop of Buenos Aires by Francis. He gave this address at a meeting with youth, young Catholics. And he told him to, you know, keep dreaming and work out there to build a better Argentina and all the very Bergoglian stuff. And this is an archbishop who repeats everything Francis says. He's one of those kind, right? You know, borderline liberation theology, the whole nine yards. And to really understand what it is that the archbishop is talking about when we go over that letter, we need to at least briefly go over this article, which comes from perfil.com. This is a Argentinian newspaper. Their website, and this is I translated this using the Google Chrome extension in case there's any kind of clunky language here. They give this the headline, The Archbishop of Buenos Aires, the poor are the new crucified. Jose Garcia Cuerva urged to seek solidarity and meeting points to build a better Argentina, based on hope and faith in the resurrection of Jesus as a source of lasting joy. Education is the only tool that takes us out of the hardcore of poverty, he reflected. Now, a lot of that isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if you're going to, you know, build a better Argentina, a good place to do it is on the hope and faith in the resurrection of Jesus. As a source of lasting joy, I mean, yes, you should have joy in the resurrection of our Lord, obviously, in the salvation that he won for you if you cooperate with his grace. Yes, obviously. But it's more complicated than that. And so, and then, of course, he qualifies it by saying education is the only tool that takes us out of poverty, which is, I mean, okay, that's demonstrably not true. But I'm going to go down to what the comments he's talked about as youth as a starting point, because this is where Hector Gore is responding to. So let's go over this short section here for context. And I'm going to make sure that this is magnified appropriately so you can actually all follow along with me if you so choose. So his interviewer asks him the following question. A few days ago, within the framework of the beginning of the new school year, you, the Archbishop Garcia Cuerva, encouraged young people not to stop dreaming, and you said, all of us who want a supportive and good Argentina are many more than the corrupt, the selfish, or the people who move interesting substances around. You know that more than anyone the social reality of what you called the new crucified. What do you think we have to do once we convince ourselves that we are more? Now, again, he's a liberation theologian, or at least he gets really close to that. He's famous for, I'm going to say some positive things about him before we go over this and before Hector Gore's letter, because we should always remember the good that people do, not to be fooled by them, but to give credit where it's due. That's a charitable thing to do. And one of the things you see that liberation theologian friendly bishops will do when they become the ordinary somewhere is they will identify the areas where there are the poorest people, and they will start sending priests to them, trying to give church services and resources to them. I don't think anybody's really got a problem with that. It's usually the rest of it that comes with liberation theology. But he was very good about making sure that the people on the peripheries, to borrow the term from Francis, were getting the help that they might need, or at least some of the help, the best help that the church could provide, and given its own context, that they could need. Here's what he had to say about building a new Argentina and knowing that we are more. Says again, this was given to young people. He says, if we convince ourselves there are more of us and that we want Argentina is better, we must agree on two or three points and stop fighting. Sometimes the success of those who seek evil lies in getting together and organizing, as those who like to move around interesting chemicals do to set prices and areas. There is a phrase that often bothers me. The only thing good people have to do for evil is to advance is nothing. We must stop always looking for differences and look for meeting points with state policies. I'm going to pause here. You may have noticed in the United States, Catholics and a lot of Protestants who their number one issue is the Moloch ritual, suddenly are very disturbed by some stuff that the once and future head of state in America has said on this issue, right? Because he's taking a moderate position. A lot of people are upset about that. Weirdly, this bishop is taking that same kind of position, not on that issue, but the underlying logic of it is we should put aside our differences and work together. So he says, for example, education is the only tool that takes us out of the hardcore of poverty. From that, we must unite and support those that are falling with the economic crisis, and each one will do it in their own way. Argentina is a mess right now economically, by the way. That's why Javier there found himself being the head of state there. The church is an assistance and accompaniment alongside the poor, and politicians will have to think about economic policies. That is to say, you have to change your heart and say, I join the different, because ultimately you also want a better world. Now, if this was a person running for public office, this is exactly what you would expect them to say, right? This is an archbishop of the church. Keep going. We'll see how long it takes before Christ comes to this. He says, you quoted the phrase from Pope Francis inviting politicians to put a human face on the economy because the humans who suffer the most have a first and last name. Almost 110 days into the new government, what face are you seeing? He says, In reality, I do not evaluate this government or the previous one in terms of the fact that the social situation has been very complicated for a long time, and I believe that we must all take charge and not have this adolescent behavior that always blames the other. We must stop putting the blame outside. I think we have to think that when measures are taken, there are brothers who are victims of those measures. Just as an adjustment, they are undoubtedly the poorest. For example, whoever's going to load his cart up, he knows that he has less and less money. Yesterday, for example, I went to buy a remedy for cholesterol. Thank God I have the possibility of buying it, but I paid 26,000 pesos, and I thought that there are people who cannot. It is not enough. Those are the human faces that we have to take into account. And then talks about, you know, inflation hits the poor the hardest. Nothing he says here is really wrong, except I want to remind you, this is a bishop of the church saying this stuff. And it's weird because he sounds like a politician, but he's the Archbishop of Argentina, of Buenos Aires. And this is why we're now going to go to Archbishop Hector Aguirre. Because remember, he said that stuff a lot to the youth. Go out and build a better Argentina. Don't stop dreaming. Materialist solutions. So what Archbishop Gore says is, with the headline here from LifeSite, church leaders are failing to preach the gospel to young people. Now, this letter is like, there's two or three different versions of the statement out there. This is the one LifeSite published. It's the one I'm going to go with. I found another one where Archbishop Gore had something published by a media outlet in Argentina on this. It says, Jorge Garcia Cuerva, Archbishop of Buenos Aires, spoke to a group of young people and had the opportunity to evangelize Jesus to them, as St. Paul would say. Instead, he urged them to build the Argentina they desire and never stop dreaming. Again, sounds like Francis, doesn't it? Kind of odd how that works out. Here's his letter. Very, very short. This is not a long thing at all. This will take almost no time to go through. So, Monsignor Jorge Garcia Cuerva, Archbishop of Buenos Aires, celebrated a mass in the Metropolitan Cathedral at the beginning of the 2024 school year. I read in La Prensa that he asked young people who are disillusioned not to leave the country and to do everything possible to build the Argentina they desire. I noticed the Archbishop's pastoral confusion. He was speaking to high school kids who are generally not disillusioned and not thinking of leaving the country for now. He also cited catchwords from Pope Francis, according to whom, quote, we must make a mess and live with enthusiasm. But the central theme was an invitation to dream. I ask all of us to dream of a better Argentina and don't stop dreaming. What should the fantasies of the dream be? Because to dream properly means to represent in fantasy images or events while we are asleep. Is it possible to dream while awake? The verb is used in a figurative sense to mean, as we read in the dictionary of the Royal Spanish Academy, quote, to think fantastically and to take as true and certain what is not so. And by extension, to yearn persistently for something and to have a craving or vehement desire to achieve something. I suppose this is the sense in which the Archbishop uses the word. A dream is a project, desire, or hope likely to be realized, and children and adolescents are potential dreamers. In Archbishop Garcia Cuerva's homily, the objects of the proposed dream are to be happy, to choose a desired profession or job, and beyond the strictly personal, a better Argentina. The problem lies in the unreality of dreams, their doubtful possibility. Hope is not a dream, but a possible future that becomes present and waiting. Words wear out with use. Consider, for example, the word love, which is misused until it loses its exact meaning, as the late Benedict XVI wisely warned us in his encyclical Deus Caritas Est. Julio Cortazar, the great writer and author of the novel Hopscotch, delivered a March 1981 speech in Paris that warned about the progressive wear and tear of words. Quote, if there's one thing we writers know, it is that words can become tired and sick, just as men or horses get tired and sick. There are words that, by dint of being repeated and often misused, end up wearing out and gradually losing their vitality. Instead of springing from mouths or writing like what they once did, arrows of communication, birds of thought and sensitivity, we see or hear them like them fall like opaque stones. We begin to not fully receive their message or to perceive only one facet of their content. We begin to feel them like worn out coins, to lose them more and more as living signs and use them like pocket handkerchiefs or used shoes. Cortazar continues, we speak because we are, but we are because we speak, hence the right words, language, and sayings that can correspond to the situation. I have perhaps dwelled too long on this point because I consider it to express the meaninglessness of the Archbishop's preaching. He had before an enormous number of children, and he should have spoken to them about Jesus. It was the right opportunity to evangelize Jesus to them, as St. Paul would say, and to get them excited about following and imitating him. I can't believe he has to be told that. We'll pause here. I can't believe that Archbishop Aguirre has to tell this to an archbishop. But that's the state of the world in the church that we're in now, that an archbishop, that he has to remind a brother bishop of his that he, that you, when you have an opportunity to preach Jesus, you should take it. Let's continue. He could show them the possibility of an integral Christian life and warn them of present dangers that constitute real temptations, such as getting entangled in social media or always walking around with a phone in their hands, where it is possible to see what should not be seen. He could show them prayer as a source of spiritual joy, how to care for the relationship with others, and how to cultivate sincere friendships in an exchange that allows them to grow as persons. It is therefore not a matter of dreaming, but of being. As the popular saying goes, dreaming costs nothing. On the other hand, being a good Christian person costs an application of and steadfastness in faith. These subjects can be approached like simplicity and in a language adapted to the understanding of children. Like good catechesis, it makes the kerygma, the proclamation of Christ, resound. Before concluding this, I received the Easter greeting of Archbishop Garcia Cuerva, published on the channel of the Episcopal Conference of Argentina. In it, the primate archbishop does not mention Jesus Christ even once. Is this the dream? Oof. Signed, Hector Aguirre, Archbishop Emeritus of La Plata. Doesn't mention Jesus once. Is this the dream? Mic drop. I mean, I've read a few things about this bishop before going live today, and he does talk about our Lord, as any bishop would, but his main focus is material, this world, the condition of people in this world. And to be sure, the church has always been concerned with that stuff. The problem with liberation theology and things aligned with it is you get this distortion of that, the elevation of the material. Material gets elevated at the expense of the spiritual, when it should be the other way, to look past the material situation. There have been plenty of people in the history of the church, in the history of our civilization, who did not have material wealth, but were the happiest, faithful people, the most satisfied people, because they had our Lord. They had faith. And so they accepted their life. They worked to improve their lot, as would be a right ordered thing to do when necessary. But they weren't in misery. And something has changed in that in the last century, especially the last century. And it takes an archbishop like Aguirre to point this out, that he'd had this opportunity to preach Jesus, and he didn't. And it's not just the liberation theologians who do this. You may have heard of this Catholic sort of, I don't want to call it an ideology because it's not. It's an application of Catholic social teaching. It's called distributism. The word is awful. It's just truly the title of it's awful. And even the progenitors of it, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, and a priest that they knew, they admit that the name is awful, but they couldn't come up with a better one. And they were coming up with prescriptions to deal with essentially industrial era capitalism. And the idea system has sort of developed on its own and broken into various branches. And one of them is very much more closely aligned with liberation theology. And the other one is weirdly more closely aligned with libertarianism now. But the name is awful. And a lot of the people who promote that, they get deep into theory. They come to it's more traditional from a Catholic perspective. But the one thing they forget to do often is when people ask them, how are you going to implement this? They always kind of hem and haw. They don't understand the answer. And the answer is, if you want to have more just society, the first thing you need to do is evangelize, actually spread the gospel, bring people to Christ, help them with having an authentic conversion to our Lord. And from there, other things will flow naturally. And then you can start having your debates about whatever more Catholic system you want to have. That's why I washed my hands a lot of that stuff years ago, is because I could see that the real problem was evangelization and bringing Christ to our Lord. The one thing the church leaders aren't all that interested in. And so I'm going to show you this as an example of what Archbishop Aguirre is talking about from an entirely different part of the world here. Make sure I have my right article queued up, because I have a lot of tabs open and they get lost. This is from katolisch.de, and this is one of the funniest things I've read in a while. This headline, how far does mutual tolerance of opinions extend in the church? Now, katolisch.de is the official news arm of the German bishops. Yeah, the same German bishops with their synodal way, and having been told by Rome that they're going too far, even for Rome on this stuff, those German bishops. That's the context of this. How far does mutual tolerance of opinions extend in the church? I'm reminded of something I read by Padre from Father Dave Nix. Maybe we'll riff on it a little bit here, because it is weirdly actually, I think, related in a somewhat way to this, except that Father Nix has got a much better take, obviously. But this, the context for this is are the German bishops and their attempt to revolutionize the church. And from it, you remember Archbishop Aguirre wanting to know where Jesus is and all of this. That's part and parcel of this. This is very short. Written by somebody calling themselves Matthias Altman, one of the editors of the website. The tone in church also seems to be getting rougher and rougher. In the public perception in this country, Germany, at least two camps are almost irreconcilably opposed, which has led some observers and theologians to even speak of a schism or schism, schism that has actually existed for a long time. Not good conditions for a church that is committed to synodality. Where have we heard that before? The United States. We've heard this everywhere in the Western church, that a schism is coming. On the occasion of the passing of Bishop Emeritus of Chur, Vitus Hondar, last week, which I reported on here, his successor, Joseph Bonhomme, said a conciliatory sentence that Pope Francis also repeatedly uses. There's room for everyone in the Catholic Church. This means, even when different positions, views, and beliefs come together, there is a need for fraternal interaction and the promotion of dialogue, unity, and understanding. A mutual condemnation and isolation could not be added. Let's pause there. Is there room for traditionalists in this? And hardline conservative Catholics? The ones who want to see Jesus preached and the material stuff, yes, addressed when at the corporal works of mercy, no one argues should be dismissed. No one argues that. But they always come in the context of preaching our Lord, Christ crucified and risen. Is there room for traditionalists and hardline conservatives who are the ones who get repeatedly canceled? And I ask this because when I see this room in the church for everybody, I have been in communication for a long time now with several different nuns from various religious orders who all say the same thing to me, that they are all watching and waiting for it to be their turn to be suppressed because they are contemplatives who spend their days in prayer. Yes, they do work also because they have to support themselves. And so they work in their community, meaning their religious community, to offer whatever services they can to meet their basic needs. But they spend their times in prayer as contemplatives have done since antiquity. And they're waiting for their turn because they're dedicated to tradition. So again, how far does mutual tolerance of opinion extend in the church? And the other question is, should that exist? Should traditionalists, on the flip side of that, tolerate the James Martins of the world and the Austin Ivereys and the rest of them who promote revolution? It says, those who cannot imagine relaxing priestly celibacy must accept the arguments of those who advocate blessings for the James Martin pairings. Do we now? Error has no rights. I haven't used that one in a while on this channel. It's one of the oldest sayings in the church. Error has no rights. The same applies. Supporters of the women's diaconate must endure friends of the old mass. Note the language there. They must endure friends of the old mass. Really? If the church doesn't just want to be one on paper, mutual tolerance of opinions is probably more important than ever in debates. Some people should realize the loyal criticism of positions that are no longer perceived as tenable must be legitimate. Every believer is concerned with a timelessly necessary question of how the church does justice to the cause of Jesus. Well, at least he mentioned Jesus there. And as far as the desires for Rome of many believers are concerned, even if Rome still rejects some with magisterial authority, the hope is that the theological arguments that have been on the table for a long time on many issues will sooner or later prevail in a synodal church not completely unfounded. The church's magisterium has certainly been good for one or two surprises in recent years. Whatever the decisions, tolerance will once again be sought after virtue. So do you see? Where's the truth in that? That's what Hector Gore was getting at, the Archbishop Emeritus of La Plata. Where's the truth? Where's Jesus? And how do you have a coexistence in the same church with people who either believe Jesus was a symbol or that the resurrection was a symbol and who are dedicated themselves to total upheaval of everything out there to those who want this the same? How does that work with the same faith that goes back to antiquity? I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm left mystified by this stuff. I'm curious what you think about this. So I'm going to check, I'm gonna shift over to the comments, to the live chat here just to see. Philip says, rightly, the apostle most interested in the material was Judas. Yeah. Fact check true. Dale Jackson, Newspeak has kids. And yeah, Newspeak has redacted to sheer frustration and confusion of basic foundation. World has lost the plot. Church used to be the anchor of the storm in the boat. Got some uncomfortable stories that I'm working on for y'all for this coming week about just that. Sonny Jim, man is corrupt and corrupts everything he touches. Only God provides hope and salvation. That's true. I will tell you that this materialist focus on the church doesn't really work. It doesn't. Why do you think parishes are emptying? People don't go to mass so they can hear what sounds like a politician speaking to them. What they want to hear is the truth. Some people are made uncomfortable by what they hear, so they go find the truth elsewhere. But that's the truth, though. Mark Becker, 80% of Catholics don't believe in the real presence. That's also true. Saw another study about that recently. Over and over again, we see these numbers. Those numbers, by the way, are the ones who go to Mass at least once in a while. We're not talking people who show up on Easter and Christmas and Ash Wednesday. We're talking about people who go to Mass once a month or more. They're the ones who don't believe in the real presence, typically, at the typical parish. Says every one of these issues have come up in various Anglican churches and are the roots of what has made them what they are today. Don't fall for the Episcopal playbook. Well, that's why I say the Synod on Synodality is pushing the new Episcopalianism. And that reminds me, I almost forgot to bring you this. So I was going to do it today to the point where I've already recorded a video for later in the week saying I talked about this today. I almost forgot. So this is an interesting letter from a former Anglican priest who became a Catholic who knows cardinals. And he wrote this letter. The story, its headline is "A Pope Destroys Christian Civilization." Catholic look at the moon, not a finger. Former Anglican prelate. Note the day of April. It's published the day before the big eclipse that everybody was focused on. This isn't long. It's super short. He says some things about the conclave that I'll touch on in a video later in the coming week. But Hector Gore's statement in that letter that I just read to you looms over this too. Let's get to this. Dear Tassati, I am an Anglican prelate converted to the Catholic faith. When I read something in the newspaper headlines that refers to our church and the pontiff, I rush to read the content immediately before reading other important news. Because what, in my opinion, explains almost everything that has happened in the world in the last 10 years is linked to this history in the same period of our beloved church to which I also adhered. The Pope was St. John Paul II, followed in the footsteps of St. John Henry Newman in 1845, but what did I do then? Never more than in these last 10 years have we felt, at least I, who am a neo-convert, the lack of a moral authority. The authority of the Catholic Church that speaks to the world about the truth, inviting it to seek it. And yet, we had a very strong and very clear warning, thanks to the two brave cardinals who proposed the first and second dubia. First in 2017 without response, the second time in 2023 with a disturbing response. Dubia, or doubts for those who don't know, ignored, even mocked, and despised. Intolerable. But what did I do then? In a recent interview, Pope Francis, I apologize, I don't remember who he gave it to. He gave it to a journalist who published it in a book called El Successor. I mentioned that last week. He explains that it was he who had Cardinal Ratzinger appointed in the 2005 conclave. Exciting! And above all, it's not true. I was an involuntary and indirect witness to it. In 2005, a group of eminent cardinals wanted to support Bergoglio's appointment. It was a great Jesuit, well, that should be in quotes, Cardinal Carlo Maria Martini, who dissuaded them and proposed Cardinal Ratzinger. The reasons, in summary, that were confided to me were that the former Archbishop of Milan would have considered this appointment of Bergoglio to the papacy a disaster for the Jesuits. It even seems that he would have said something like, if he is elected pope, we Jesuits will, in fact, be 1773. It's time not for years, but for at least 200. He became the current pontiff, and what he had done in his previous functions in Argentina is well known, with testimonies. It is difficult to prove and attest to who wanted him and why, but in the very first day of his appointment to the papal throne, that is, long before he began to govern the church, For many quarters, it was explained what his task would be, 100% done. A book was even published by a French intellectual who joked about the consequences of that choice. Benedict had to resign so Francis could be Pope. Francis had to be Pope because Benedict would never have allowed the church to support the decisions made later to destroy Christian civilization. It's an interesting accusation to put on Francis. Perhaps many Catholics have not yet understood that what was destroyed, beyond faith, of course, is Christian civilization. Well, I'm really afraid that many of you Catholics have not yet understood this. You look at the finger, but you don't understand what it's pointing to. I would also like to make a critical observation of the behavior of some prelates who are preparing for the supposed change of pontificate, expressing negative evaluations of the pontificate suddenly and with suspicious delay. Marmalesque evaluations, dear Tosati, that in no way can be shared. I explain the expression marmalesca, which means vile. Upon his arrival in Italy in 1527, Charles V, Catholic Holy Roman Emperor, eager to punish Pope Clement VII for having joined the Cognac League, had hired the Lansquenite Protestant mercenaries who carried out the famous sack of Rome and carried the affliction of the day throughout Italy. During the siege of Florence in 1530, the famous Marmolato, a Neapolitan mercenary, attacked the commander Francesco Ferrucci, already wounded and half expired on the ground, doing violent things to him and yelling pretty vile stuff too. Now, dear Tosati, until yesterday, everyone, except very few, were sock lickers and allowed everything that happened. Now, everyone is bravely critical with interviews and even with books that are not credible, referring to the previous pope post-mortem, of course, meaning they're trying to ally themselves with Benedict because they believe we're in the waning days of Francis's papacy, something I'd caution people to believe. To rather take that with a grain of salt that they were in the waning days of Francis's papacy just yet. I don't think he'll be here another 10 years, but people act like he'll be gone this year or something. You should be very careful with that. It is curious that in addition to the famous Cardinals of the Dubia and some others, only in this moment of progressive weakening of Francis, little by little, some neo-braves slowly do emerge, suffering from the Marmalesque contagion. This is not exemplary and makes us fear that even worse times are ahead. Etc., etc. It's a warning from a former Anglican prelate who became a Catholic priest, who knew priests at the conclave. And he's watching how a lot of these same bishops now who sang Francis's praises are now distancing themselves. And he thinks it's a ruse because he thinks we another Francis is sect. It's the kind of thing that you expect to see. And all of this, where is Jesus? Not where is Jesus in the literal sense, but in the discourse, in the teachings, and the focuses of the church on the synodality and all this stuff. Where is Jesus? It's a question Hector Aguirre was asking. I'm curious what you think about all this. Let me know in the comments, please. And once again, I'll put a link to it here in the live chat. Thanks for the those of you who are supporting the Give, Send, Go that a viewer started. It's great. Appreciate it. I think we're at like 2/3 of the way there now, which is great. So let me know what you think of all this, though, in the comments, please. Like and subscribe if you haven't. It does help. As to sharing this on social media, that helps, too. As always, pray for the church. I'm Anthony Stein. Ave Maria.